Welcome to the admissions preseason meeting, as we call it. Preseason meeting and a bit of a workshop. This is a bit of an unfortunate room because I have to sort of keep scanning left to right to see everybody. So I won't be able to. I may not see your questions if you have them. So make sure that you make yourself well known if you do have questions. First thing that I want to do, for those of you that don't know me, my name is Salim Razak, and I'm the admissions Assistant Dean of Admissions, Equity, and Diversity. This meeting is a meeting to bring you up to date on where we're at with admissions for this season. We also have the opportunity to do a little bit of training as well, so there are a couple training exercises in there. And the goal really is for us to standardize our practice of selection as much as possible so that everybody's on the same page about what we're looking for and how we're trying to evaluate it, and also that your important questions are answered. So you should feel free to ask questions. The one thing that I will say is that this session is being recorded because not everybody was able to attend this workshop. So that if you do have questions, what we will do is we will pass you a microphone so that you can be part of the discussion that becomes recorded and that is going to be posted on Center Stage for admissions committee members that cannot be here. A couple of housekeeping points. We will be using clickers today. So, and I'll explain to you how those work for those of you that are not familiar. I believe the students in the room are going to be extremely familiar with clickers. But it's a way of being interactive in the presentation. And we will explain how to use them when the time comes. Very easy to do. For anybody who's ever watched America's Funniest Home Videos, it's a little bit like that when they make the decision about which videos win. I think that importantly, those clickers are expensive, so please don't walk away with them today. Make sure you hand them back in. Expensive for us if they are not returned. And I think that that's it about the clickers. Right. So there are some documents inside the... You can take stuff home today from those folders that you have, but there are some documents that do need to stay here, and I would ask you to leave them on the table when you're leaving. Those are the two fictionalized files that you have and the two multiple mini-interview stations that you have. Those are confidential documents that we want to keep here. I think that's it. I don't think there's anything else that I have to say. I'm going to just launch right into it. Who here is new? So there's quite a few of you that are new this year. And I think that this is really for you. It's really a situation where you are able to be oriented to the admissions process. So please ask your questions as you have them. Just because this session is has also been approved for continuing health professions education credits, we just have to state that we have no conflicts of interest to declare. And this reminds me that you will all receive, we're trying to be more paperless this year, so you will all receive a PDF certificate of attendance in email after the presentation, and for the, it's going to be mostly important for those of you who can claim credits for that. So we're going to do a little bit of a welcome plenary. We're going to review the changes for the 2014 cycle, and we're going to do a file review practicum where we will use clickers and we will try and understand how to score and how to set standards around the reviewing of files. Then Rob, who is in the room, actually, Rob Primavesi, right there, will present a little bit on the new curriculum, which just rolled out this year, and let us know. I think the idea is to, because one of our important principles is alignment with curriculum, so that we can sort of know what implications that has for us in student selection. Following that, we'll have two reports, the reports from David on the Admissions Best Practices Advisory Committee, the activities of the year, and Outreach and Widening Participation Committee. Charmaine will give an update on that because Dr. Ferdinand was not able to be here. Then we'll have a break, and we're going to do a simulated MMI practicum where, again, we're going to look at scoring and standards in the performance, and we have graciously received the thespian services of several students who will be helping us with that up here. And at the end, we'll wrap up. And are we allowed to give them lunch? Do we have lunch? Yes. There's always a question about lunch these days, right? Because of the budget cuts. But we are able to give you lunch, so there is some lunch. So welcome. What are the educational objectives? The educational objectives of this morning are that you, at the end, we hope that you're able to describe the current practices and also relate them to relevant policies for student selection for entry into medicine at McGill. That you will have had the opportunity through practice to apply the current practices and policies to student selection to medical school, and we attend to fairness, uniformity of standards, and psychometric rigor as we're doing all of that. And finally, to sort of discuss the ways in which student selection is aligned, or that we seek to align it to the curriculum and to McGill's mission of excellence and social accountability. I thought it would be important for you to appreciate the guiding principles of the office. So some of you in this room were at the 2012 retreat, in which we sort of had a reflective space and we sort of thought about what we're about, what are our obligations to society, what new changes such as the Future of Medical Education in Canada document, how these things affect student selection at McGill. And through that, we actually were able, through the participation of approximately 70 faculty members, so members of the admissions committee, members of curriculum, and so on, we were able to define some guiding principles for our office. So the first guiding principle is that we seek excellence. And I think each of these has with it a text of two or three sentences. But within the seeking excellence text is the notion that it is beyond grades, that there are multiple excellences that we might seek, and that it's a complex interplay of a person's educational background and their other experiences. A second guiding principle is the notion of inclusivity. So the issue is to be welcoming to all kinds of people. And kinds of people sounds like a strange way to say it, but for instance, an example of that would be to be fully committed to a bilingual process. That's part of being inclusive. The third step, guiding principle, is the idea of alignment. So what we are doing cannot exist in a vacuum. It needs to be understood in terms of the curriculum that we send students to and the desired products of that curriculum in terms of the competencies that students are expected to achieve at the end. So that's the third point. And the last two are really about about the client, about the student. So we want students to feel that they have gone, and to actually, beyond feeling, to actually have gone through a fair process in the ways that fairness is defined. And related to that is the notion of transparency. So students know what is going to happen to them when they come to the multiple mini interviews. They know how their file is treated. They know what weighting we put on different aspects of their file and so on. So transparency is also an important part of our tasks. So I reported in last year's meeting, but we reorganized a little bit the admissions governance structure last year, related to the fact that it had been a few years into the multiple mini interviews, and you know, this is a very, very big change to the process of student selection. And this required a sort of a change in how we do things. For those of you that have ever been involved in national credentialing exams, such as I have, for instance, in pediatrics, I feel that this process is much, much more like a national credentialing exam because of the multiple mini interviews than it is like any other form of selection. So we drew some inspiration from the way that national credentialing exams are organized to help us reorganize a little bit the way the admissions committee works. So we have an admissions committee, and you are the admissions committee, and you are almost like a board of evaluators. Your job is to know the policies, is to apply selection in rigorous and standard-setting ways, and to participate in the changes to the policies as they move forward. So that's the admissions committee, and the guiding principle that most applies here is seeking excellence. And I put the guiding principles, or we put the guiding principles there, but they're not the only ones that apply. They all apply everywhere, but that's sort of one that comes out in prominence. So then there's the notion of transparency and fairness, and really that's the job of... try and do it here, and I think that there will also be an opportunity. I think that there will also be an opportunity when Rob talks about the curriculum to really talk about that, to really address that issue as well. So, in terms of transparency and fairness, in the Office of Admissions, Equity, and Diversity, the real job is to manage hundreds of emails, drop-ins, thousands of files, and to make sure that every single one of those people feels heard and feels that they are participating in a fair process, and really to apply the policies that are developed kind of in this committee and in the advisory committee, which I'll talk about in a second. In terms of inclusivity is everywhere. But in particular, inclusivity is in our widening participation committee, whose job is to really oversee the outreach activities in the health professions that we have. We have multiple, and you'll hear about them a little later on, we have multiple programs going on, but these outreach programs involve indigenous communities, schools in disadvantaged areas of Montreal, and also rural areas as well. So that's what that committee does. In terms of alignment, I'll talk a little bit about alignment here with the Professionalism Standards Committee. So that committee is chaired by Dr. Namta Gupta. And if you all remember, those of you that are, shall we say, ancien combattant, veterans here, you remember our discussions around flagged behaviors and how those could sometimes come to blows or words. Whenever students did things in, for instance, in multiple mini interviews that were concerning. So we had never liked that process. We felt that it was not a good way to manage those observations that are made by evaluators. So what we did was we decided to move. So evaluators still flag behaviors. So if someone says something, crosses a boundary in a multiple mini interview, for instance, and someone flags it, so that is still discussed, but it's referred to a specific committee composed of Namta Gupta, Rob, and actually Bethann Cummings. And the idea of alignment is there because what we've done is we've chosen to apply the code of conduct that our faculty has as our guiding way to judge those behaviors. In terms of another sort of area where there's alignment, there's the MMI or M3I, McGill MMI Review Committee, which is currently meeting. It's meeting, it met one time in October and is meeting another time in November. That committee, the goal of that committee is to set an exam, really. I'm going to call it an exam because it feels like that. To design the 5 days of multiple mini interviews that we run and to make sure that that each day is equivalent to other days, to fit it within a blueprint and to look critically at the stations that you all submit through the lens of, I'll sort of say scripting. So the idea of is this a good scenario or does it need tweaking, through the lens of diversity, are there opportunities to sort of increase the diversity within the scenarios in all kinds of ways, and through the lens of alignment again. And that mostly goes with designing a marking paper, a marking grid that fits with what we're trying to evaluate within the station. So that's what that committee does mostly. And we have several members of that committee. I don't think that any of them are... Jay Netto's here. Okay. And we have other members. Dr. Fuchs, who is a prolific contributor of stations, and others. Any questions? So what is the role of committee members, you all? The role is to of committee members, the roles are to evaluate the non-academic elements of candidacies. So file review at the pre-screening stage, so that is looking at the this year, and we'll hear about it in a second. We've got a combined submission of a CV and a personal narrative that you'll be looking at, and to participate in multiple mini-interview selection at the selection stage. I think another important thing is to maintain the confidentiality and integrity of the process. So that is why we ask you all to sign confidentiality agreements. To recuse yourself from the process whenever you've got a conflict in a particular year. Maybe your nephew's applying or your very good friend or your son. So to recuse yourself from the process and to contribute to the development of policy and improvements of the process. And one important point is, you know, as we've got this new situation of a newly organized system, if you have any questions about the process or anything that you want referred, and I'll give you an example, just to give you an idea, maybe this is one that came up from the community, actually. So maybe we need to review In light of the fact that we have kind of now a four-year experience of not requiring MCATs for the vast majority of our candidates, maybe we need to review it, whether it's needed for the other candidates that apply to our programs as well. That's something that recently came to the committee. Or maybe you have a question about a particular policy. You should be referring those, and feel free to refer those to David Luco, who's the chair over there, who's just raising his hand, who's the chair of the Admissions Advisory Best Practices Committee, which is charged with kind of advising on policy. So excellence in applicants to our medical school is under, this is the wording from the retreat, is understood as a complex concept, demonstrated as a balanced interplay between scientific and academic ability, intellectual curiosity, humanism, rigor, and community engagement. So these are the things, broadly, that we are looking for in our applicants. How is the selection process working this year? So we have the pre-screen for invitation to interview, and we don't have the CGEP applicants yet. Those students apply on March 1st is their deadline. But we're well over 2,000 already with all of the other applicants. So we're projecting to be very similar to last year in the 2,800-2,900 range. So in those dossiers, 70% of your score is the academic dossier. That roughly corresponds to your grade point average. We do look at your grade point average. So strictly numbers there. There is a small 10 point factor, so 10 out of the 70, that looks for certain countable things. Okay, the countable things are and gives a bit of weighting in the positive for those. The countable things are coming from a professional program, master's and PhD level work. A notion of having done, you know, sort of full coursework over time. So those are countable things that contribute to a little part of the academic evaluation as well. The other 30% is the non-academic dossier, which is a CVPN, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And this, Milen? Yeah. It's very similar to the French schools. It's and this is a thing, and we're going to talk a little bit about the stuff that was in the paper this summer. But so we've had a tripling from 2003, from 1,000 to about 3,000. In Canada and in the U.S., what has been observed has been about a doubling. Okay. We're definitely part of this trend of increasing admission demands. The part that's the tripling is probably coming from local factors such as removing the MCAT and so on, which is actually a desired effect of what we did. And how does this compare to other schools? And this is the point that's I think important to come out. We're just beginning to approach the kind of competitiveness. This is the kind of competitiveness that a student, say, in Toronto would have, applying to the University of Toronto. University of Toronto gets 3,500 to 4,000 demands of admission per year for a slightly bigger class, right? So it's kind of like very similar to that. So the way I look at this is that our competitiveness is approaching what it should be, rather than it's coming from a different place, but it's approaching what it should be. In terms of the final selection, for all MDCM applicants, we have 80% of the score going to the multiple mini interviews, and 20% of the score going to something we're calling a basic science performance score. And what that is looking specifically at the prerequisite courses, so organic chemistry, physics, the different prerequisites. Sorry? Biology and chemistry. The lawyer's letting me know. I'm just teasing. The reason we did that was brought in 2 years ago. The reason that we did that was when the MCAT was taken away, there was a certain discomfort, not discomfort, but there was a certain... we wanted to capture sort of scientific ability in some way, shape, or form. And this is the way that we have chosen to do it, and it seems to be working out well. For those students who are in the Med-P program, because the Med-P program is very, very defined and contains actually a lot of science to begin with, we actually base it 100% on the MMI. So we don't use a science score because that would sort of be like double counting. And then there are two other categories of applicants, the IMG applicants. So those are international medical graduates who are applying to our programs to be admitted with advanced standing, of which there are generally around 2 spots per year. That's how we replace attritions, basically. Those candidates have as a requirement for their evaluation, having written the Medical Council of Canada evaluating qualifying exams or evaluating exams, and that contains a lot of basic science. It's a standardized test already, so we don't use a basic science score because we would then be using transcripts that might be from Algeria or something that would be hard for us to understand with a very different course of study. And then the non-traditional pathway applicants who are being admitted, of which there are 3 per year, who are being admitted on the basis basically of having a non-traditional background. This is the selection tools that are. These are the selection tools that are used for the international medical graduates. So the evaluating exam from the Medical Council of Canada, the medical school performance report from their universities at which they got their medical degree, and then the MMI. Snapshot of applications. Just looking at time. Okay, I'm going to speed it up a little bit. Just Quebec. Residents were 847 with a university degree, were 847 last year. Just to give you, that's the biggest growth that we've seen in terms of a particular cohort. That cohort in 2003 was 297, or 200 in the 200s. The others remain strong, and again, we had 2,831 applicants this year. The point of this slide is to help, again, sure. Can you speak up? The purpose of this slide is not to stress you out with a lot of numbers, but to really show you, and in particular, to show you in the Quebec University graduates how academic standards have been going up. Okay, so in 2011, 3.72 was the average interviewed GPA. In 2012, 3.8 was the average interviewed GPA, and 3.83 last year. And if we went back to 2003, we would have seen a lower number, like around 3.6. This is to, again, because you all are ambassadors for our process, and there are a lot of rumors going on out there, particularly around the dropping of the MCAT. I think what the message is that with the increased competition that has resulted from larger numbers of people applying, our academic standards have gone up. That's the message to take from this. So, any questions about that? Grade inflation I don't know. Okay, but I'll start by saying I don't know. I will say that regularly each year we receive from several Ivy League schools, we receive kind of like these brochures that say that basically say, you know, we don't do grade inflation, right? Right. So it's sort of like these kind of defensive brochures that sort of say, you know, I'm just going to invent one, at UPenn, we don't do grade inflation. So I think it's a conversation that goes on a lot more in the United States. Okay, I don't know. So again, the fact that the conversation isn't going on as much in Canada, to me, I'm not sure if that means that it's not going on or it's just not being appreciated, right? So the legacy admission idea, again, that's actually an accreditation standard that we don't really have. We don't have legacy programs. It doesn't stop people from trying. that's been a little part of my growing up, to learn a little bit about that. So in terms of, I think what I'd like to sort of talk about now is the external review of the office that was undertaken. And I just want to check out time. How behind am I? Okay. I actually think that this is an important discussion. So we're going to take our time and do this, actually. Yeah. So there was an external review of the Admissions Equity Diversity Office, that was undertaken on October 8th, 2013. And the two reviewers were, the external reviewer was Dr. Harold Reiter from McMaster University, one of the important pioneers in the multiple mini interview process. So that's sort of why I think we felt that he was an excellent external reviewer, and always because understanding the internal complexities is an important part of any external review, there's always an internal reviewer. So the internal reviewer was Dr. Armand Delamian, who some of you may know. And that review, you have actually the report with you, okay? So a couple of things about that report. We are the first external review to be done with a kind of a new policy on the part of our dean, which I actually really applaud. So this report is going to be posted on the dean's website. There's another external review that's been done recently, which is the MD-PhD program as well. So that will also be posted. That represents a very significant culture shift for McGill. Previously, that would not have happened, that an external review would be shared. I actually think it's great. I think it's, it actually fits with transparency, right? The guiding principles of transparency. So in the spirit of full transparency, I will tell you that that report has been redacted by the dean's office in one paragraph. And that paragraph is a paragraph that can, because I was very frank with them, I actually gave them very specific examples of things that happen. that could be identifying to students, particular students and so on, we ask them to turn them into generalities rather than referring specifically to a student. And by that I mean that the student or a relative of the student would be able to identify who that was based upon the situation described. But it has not been changed in any other way. Okay? So that report is the report from Drs. Ryder and Alamian. I'll just say that I thought it was one of the best written external reviews I've ever seen. It was actually written in a literary style truly got at the heart of all of the issues, and it was very, very helpful to us, and it was a very useful thing. So the thing I wanted to say is, why was there an external review? I think, so this external review was actually planned before the summer troubles, as we call them, the stuff in the paper. It was actually planned last spring, but it's really part of the same set of issues. So I think in my mind, it's all put together. So there's a lot of internal and external pressures on our process. One big one is that we have to meet the requirements of the Future of Medical Education in Canada document and the concomitant accreditation standards, which involve outreaching to communities not represented in medicine, and which created some tensions, particularly with our colleagues, my colleagues, I would say, in terms of colleagues who might who might be viewing, well, what about my children getting into medicine? That sort of idea, right? And I think that those are perceptions. I think the reality is that, 15% of our class has one or two parents that is a doctor. So I think that, it's important to address the realities, but also to recognize the perceptions. I think a second thing, and the dean actually has a whole slew of planned external reviews. Previous to us, the Simulation Center was externally reviewed as well. And then us, and then the MD-PhD program. There are some others that are planned after that. But periodic peer review is an important part of any university's excellence. And I think that this is all going on in our office has not changed in size in terms of staffing from the time that it had 1,000 applicants to 3,000 applicants, right? So that's a huge stress on the process as well. And I think that a fourth leitmotif is that there is this notion that, maybe in the health professions at McGill, we should share some of our best practices in student selection so that we could be more efficient and so on as well. So that's why the external review occurred. And then we had the sort of the changing face of the McGill medical student. So who's had a chance to read the article and the concomitant articles and the op-ed piece? So most of you. I'm not really going to go through it. I'm just going to say that it was, so I was interviewed in April for this article. And if those of you that remember, about 2 or 3 weeks before April, in March, there had been a similar kind of major front page news thing around the new curriculum and basic sciences in the new curriculum. So I think it needs to be situated within that that context. But in this article, there was a fair bit of, how to say it, there was a, she didn't, the journalist didn't quite refute strongly enough. So we, when we were interviewed, when I was interviewed, I basically said that, people compete and they try their best to get in, and that we have no quotas, all this kind of thing, and that the outreach that's done is really about widening the pool, right? The pool of applicants. And I think that if I look at the article and I sort of see where one of the major sort of areas where a little seed of doubt could be injected came from, was that she said that McGill maintains that it will not apply any quotas, right? Which is just sort of enough of a doubt that that got seeded in there to make it to provoke a bit of a reaction. And the second thing that occurred, of course, was that and the students in the audience, I don't feel uncomfortable saying this because I've actually spoken to him, but I did feel that there was an unfortunate portrayal of your colleague in there. That in my own, I was actually on vacation when it occurred. But being a pediatrician, we're not even paternalistic; we're kind of maternalistic. It sort of provoked the maternal, like, is he okay kind of idea for me. I think he is okay, but it was an unfortunate portrayal, and then it provoked a response that. That was very unfortunate and very divisive, that really required the writing of the op-ed piece. And I don't know, I think one thing that happened after the op-ed piece was that a lot of conversation stopped, which is what we wanted. I don't know if it changed anything about perceptions, but the op-ed piece was honestly a statement of what we do. I actually wrote it, so it was there. But I think that what I wanted the opportunity to talk about here is to really get an idea that, you know, this comes from somewhere, right? This reaction has come from somewhere. And to really make sure that we address it in ways that you can be ambassadors. I actually, before we move forward with the discussion, I just want to open it up to any comments that anybody may have or any thoughts that they may have. Is there anybody that nobody wants to say anything? So the question is that because we actually run a bilingual process, how do we know that how do we know that the process is equivalent in both English and French? And in actual fact, in each end of season, that is part of the analysis that's done. In each end of season meeting, one of the things that I always present is Francophone performance by day and Anglophone performance by day, so that we're able, and the numbers are usually large enough for us to make good inference. What I can say is that in each year, the two curves have almost always, in a kind of a scary kind of way, completely mapped onto each other in terms of a bell curve that's created. So I think we have strong evidence that we put on an equivalent process in both languages, and there's actually quite a process about that in terms of translation and so on. As you know, it's not an exact science, right? So it always provokes reactions. You know, did you do this the right way? Is it the right cultural reference that we're doing, and so on. Milan?
Was it
So I actually think that it was timed because I was on vacation, but that's just me. Yeah. Because everything's about me. I think it was timed to be very close to the admitting of the new class. Like the new class was coming within a week of that, right? Like, so I think that that was sort of one important part of the timing. And in actual fact, it had some negative effects on the admitting of the new class, which were addressed by the dean. And I don't know, Rob may want to talk about it a little bit, but there were several Francophone students who, for instance, wrote me saying, you know, are we still welcome here? That kind of idea, right? So I think that this is serious stuff that happened, right? But you know what? In some ways, one of the things that it helped crystallize, and I don't know if I'm becoming a bit radical with it, but I really, like, I say the word inclusivity all the time now, in all of what we do. It's really about that. It's about making sure that anybody who comes here feels welcome and that they can be a part of this place, right? If they have the ability, right? Because we're seeking excellence. So I think that that's another sort of key message that needs to regularly go out. And I do feel that it goes out because actually a lot of the stuff that came from students was actually after the op-ed piece as well. Thank you. Thank you for saying that, you know, it was just as hard for us to get in. That was sort of a message that I got from students in the class already. That I thought is an important one to sort of say. Questions, comments? Speak loudly, please. So there's a couple of things that you can say about that. One is one that I would never have wanted to come out in the papers, okay? But here's a kind of like a number thing that you can think about. So Anglophones make up about 8.5% of the population of Quebec. McGill has about 22%, 21 or 22% of the medical spots in the province. So that's already a thing to think about, right? So there really are, and the competitiveness is just beginning to approach what everybody else in the country has to deal with, right? So there's that. That argument won't work because that is not someone's reality. That's a reality from stepping back. But the other thing is that, I actually wish that the French schools would change, their, rules around language. Language has a long history of being used as a tool of exclusion, particularly by the two world's great colonizing languages, which are English and French. I think that it could definitely be looked at through that lens, but that's not the side of the street that we must sweep, right? We must sweep our own side of the street. Rob, you had a comment? Speak loud. That's about right. It's still the majority of the class that identify themselves anyway. Yeah. Any other, Anita? Just in terms of trying to create some of the So data releasing is you know, we actually put on our website all of these data and have been for a few years. But yes, it's actually part of the recommendations that come from the external review. The external review, from my point of view, basically said, you guys do a good job. You have some problems with internal communications, actually. One of the biggest things that I learned, and I was talking to Diane and Nancy over there about it, the biggest things that I learned, and perhaps I'm a bit thick with this, is that in the beginning I saw this as a media thing that played out on the inside. But now I see it as an inside thing within the faculty that perhaps played out a little bit in the media. And I think that what that really means is that we need to make sure that our internal colleagues are aware. So many of our colleagues do not know that there are two accreditation standards related to diversity that must be met in order for the school to be accredited by the LCME and CACIMS, the American and Canadian bodies for accreditation. So that it's a no-negotiation kind of thing. Right? I think I'm just going to move on and describe some of the stuff from the internal review. So this is who the internal reviewers met with. And you have the report, so I'll go through that a little bit more quickly. But they made recommendations on communications and messaging. That was their major, major thing. They said that you need to make sure your colleagues know all of these things that you live under. And that is something that we're actively working with the communications office, developing an internal and an external communication strategy. There were some small process things because we have a new process. One of the things that they encouraged was the separation. They liked the fact that we've got an advisory committee, a widening participation committee, professionalism standards committee, and so on. The one thing is that as of at the end of this year, because I'll see this process through, I'm going to step down as the MMI review committee guy, and we're going to seek someone else to do that so that I'll still be stepped up from the process a bit. And we shared it with you all, with Deanery. It will be shared with Deanery. It's just hot off the press right now, with Faculty Leadership Council, and with the public as well. So this will be posted on the Dean's website. What does this imply for committee members? I think it's really important that conflict of interest policies be rigorously enforced. We do rigorously enforce them. But we really, really want to make sure that if you have a conflict, that you step away from the process for the year that you have the conflict. And the second one, Blima was talking a little bit about legacy admissions and so on, and this is a constant stress. It's a constant thing that happens each year, that people ask us things that I would have never believed. If you get money, will you let my kid in? You know, that kind of thing, which we don't, we never react to. But I think what it means is that we must always have, so the process must be spread out decision making, so it's less corruptible. We have an unhappy marriage with who we share our offices with. Our offices are shared with alumni relations, believe it or not. Because McGill has metastasized all over the place, right? So we don't think we should be there, and we didn't think we should be there before we went there, but that's where we got put. They also agree that we shouldn't be there. Those kinds of things are really, really important. And we're going to clarify governance structures. We're going to make sure that all of you know about the appropriate channels for policy change and standard setting today. So I won't go through this because it's actually in the report, but those are the basic areas that we're going to look at things, and we're going to report to the dean in June 2014 and in December 2014 as well. So any questions or comments before we move on? How are we doing for time? We're about 15, 20 minutes behind. 30 minutes behind. All right. We'll be okay. We'll try and catch up some time. We'll certainly finish on time. Any questions or comments from the students? I'd be interested in the student response to if there is. So, and I think, so first of all, don't get me started on Bill 60. But I think that one thing, just before I respond to that, just to go back to the article itself, I think one thing is that everything has to be understood through this lens, right? Like, it's going on in the situation, it's not related at all to Bill 60, but it's going on in a place where Bill 60 was proposed, right? So that's already an issue. I think that we have excellent statements of inclusivity that have come out from our major teaching hospitals, in particular the Jewish General Hospital. Okay, the Jewish General Hospital is a statement of civil disobedience, right? So it actually tips over to civil disobedience, which I'm really quite fine with, and I'll be right there with them, okay? The MUHC has not tipped over to civil disobedience, but a pretty strongly worded statement as well. So I think that the leadership really sees the inclusivity issue with Bill 60. So I mean that's it. So we have it's an unknown terrain. We're having it's something that will come, that it's being voted in the sort of highest levels of power, right? So we're in some ways subject to it, but we are resisting it, right? It's being resisted broadly within the McGill community, actually, and there's many allies all over the place with it. So any other comments? So perhaps, I mean, we are working with our PR department with it. I guess what I would say is that we are totally open to suggestions about how to make this better. And I actually think that the first place to attack is with our internal community, because this is really where it's coming from. It's colleagues with kids who didn't get in, basically, is a big part of what's going on here, and we need to assuage that in some way. I mean the first thing that's going to happen is that next week I'm going to be presenting all of this stuff at Deanery, so that's the goal. The way Deanery works is that it sort of trickles, supposed to trickle down to Joe Blow at the hospital, or Josephine Blow at the hospital, who's more likely to be Josephine these days. That doesn't always happen. That's the structure that's been proposed to us. If you have ideas, please send them to me, and please, we're happy to talk. We actually would be, with your experience, we'd be happy to talk with you and with Diana, who is the communications person together. Any other questions or comments? I don't know, Rob, do you want to say anything, or not really, or? All right. Okay.